I'm Ben Kiefer, and if you're with us, you're listening to a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I meant to say, if you were with us yesterday, you remember we devoted an entire hour to memories of this day 50 years ago when our nation was struck down by the news of John Kennedy's assassination. Yesterday, we heard accounts from Chuck Grassley, Dave Loebsack, Jim Leach, Sally Mason, Tim Walch, all people with that tragedy in their living memory. Well, we also asked you for your memories of that day. The problem was our hour wasn't long enough to accommodate all those stories, so we wanted to present some of your views in the next few minutes. Here's a Facebook post on our Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page from Shelley about that day. I was supposed to be napping on the couch in the living room, and Mom was making Dad's lunch in the kitchen. I remember they were arguing about something, and Walter Cronkite interrupted Mom's soaps and made the announcement. I went to the kitchen to tell them, and they ran to the living room to see. I mostly remember it as their argument stopping because they were hugging each other. I was 5 at the time. I also recall that Nana, Mom's mom, said the rosary nonstop throughout the next days and that we had the TV on constantly. I was sitting on Nana's lap when Jack Ruby shot Oswald. Traumatic for a kid that grew up with the Kennedy brothers' picture on each side of the crucifix over the TV in our living room. Thank you for that Facebook post from Shelley, one of our listeners. Here are a number of other Iowa Public Radio listeners who called remembering 50 years ago, November 22nd, 1963.
My name is Teresa Schulte, and I'm from Ackley, Iowa. Well, I was in my grandmother's living room up in Charles City, and what I remember is I was 5 years old. I had just gotten done with morning kindergarten, and my mom had picked me up, and we went over to my grandma's house, and so we had just gotten settled, and As the World Turns came on, and then they broke in with the news that the president had been shot. I remember my grandmother, her name was Dorothy Jorgensen, and she was devastated. She was such a strong supporter of JFK, and she was just devastated in tears. And I just remember very, very upset people around me, my aunts and uncles coming to my grandparents' home, and just very sad people.
My name is Fred Doman. I'm calling from Platteville, Wisconsin. Well, I was a student at the Milwaukee Institute of Technology. I was about 25 years old, and I was removing equipment from the physics lab, putting it away, when the loudspeaker came over the loudspeaker that President Kennedy had been assassinated. Well, of course, I stopped in my tracks, as everyone did, but what I will never forget is that the chairman of the physics department, who was sitting about 15 or 20 feet away from me, sitting at his desk, turned around and said, "That's the best damn news I've heard since the end of the war." And I was taken aback a second time, not believing how crass a person could be, even if the individual was not the president of the United States.
I'm Jane Nettleton, and I live in Algona, Iowa. I had met John F. Kennedy when I was a senior in high school, and I was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican at that time, and I was in a class with other people and two guys who were dyed-in-the-wool Democrats, and we were in northern Illinois, and those two guys had been asked to usher at a JFK event while he was running for president, and they asked two of us to go with them. So we went to DeKalb, Illinois. We were the ushers, and afterwards we got to meet him. And we got his autograph, shook his hand. And the main thing I remember, since I was such a Republican, was that I'm very tall, and he seemed like he wasn't very tall. And he was very tan and wrinkled for such a young guy. Then in 1963, when I was at Iowa State University and we were on the quarter system, I was taking a final on November 22nd, but first I had to type a paper, and I was frantically typing when somebody ran into my room and said they had been in the chapter room at our sorority and that they had heard that the president had been shot. So I turned on my radio, and I was trying to type, and I was trying to listen, and then we heard the news that he was dead. And we just all gathered in the chapter room, and we were all crying because it was such a devastating thing. He was so young. And then after that, All finals were canceled at Iowa State, and we were all sent home. And I went home to, at that time, our family was living in Dubuque, and we just gathered around the TV, and we sat there. I don't even remember if we went to bed. We must have, but just sat there watching all the events that transpired, and it was just the saddest weekend that I can ever remember. It felt like, is our country going to recover? What is really going to happen to us all?
My name is Ken Choquette, and I'm calling from Des Moines. That's where I live. And I was going to a class, and at St. Ambrose, they had house cleaners. And a real nice black lady was the house maid there, and I walked downstairs, and she was crying next to the door, and I asked her why, and she said that the president was shot. And so, of course, it was a shock. She was bawling, crying. Then I went off to class, and the class had been shut down, but everyone was just talking about wondering what happened next. That was before they knew he was actually dead. I think it was the time he was just shot. When I was a freshman at St. Ambrose, then Senator Kennedy was running for election. The election would be that following November. This is in September. And I had an opportunity to meet him personally. I shook his hand, but I remember one of his assistants was sitting next to him. And he asked me, and this was before President Kennedy was president, he asked me about what I thought about volunteering. He didn't say Peace Corps at the time because I don't think they even named it. What I think about volunteering for overseas 2 years after I graduate from college. And I don't remember exactly what I told him, but give me an idea that stayed with me during my 4 years at St. Ambrose, which I ended up joining the Peace Corps and went to Pakistan for 2 years.
This is Joan Roberts, and I'm calling from Des Moines. Well, President Kennedy's inaugural address inspired me to join the Peace Corps. And I was in one of the early groups in the Philippines, and I was in a southern island, and my housemate, another volunteer, and I had gone to the city for the weekend, and we woke up in the middle of the night to hear a news flash on the radio, Voice of America. We were just completely devastated and felt completely alone. Bobby Kennedy had come to the airport to see us off, and J. Rockefeller IV was our escort officer. We really felt like we were, you know, the president's ambassadors, and we were just devastated and couldn't believe it. But we received a telegram from the Peace Corps the next morning confirming that he had been killed. We grew up. We were no longer just college kids having kind of a lark, doing something we thought maybe our president wanted us to do. We looked at the whole world differently. And the Filipinos were, I've heard people on the radio talk about how silent it was. When we went out in the city, people, it was completely silent there, and they stood with bowed heads and said, your president is dead. President Kennedy is dead. I mean, we were just, it moved the entire world. It really inspired all of us to be better people, I think.
Five of our Iowa Public Radio listeners, thank you so much for those remembrances of this day 50 years ago. Joan Roberts and Ken Choquette of Des Moines, Jane Nettleton of Algona, Fred Doman of Platteville, Wisconsin, and Teresa Schulte of Ackley, Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition. Joining me now to talk not only about this 50th anniversary of a national tragedy, but also another anniversary this week is Tom Schwartz, a Lincoln historian and now director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tom Schwartz, welcome to our studio.
Thank you, Ben.
Listening to those memories together, I was struck by especially one early on that showed that Kennedy was not loved by all at the time.
Yes, and unfortunately my memory falls along those lines. I grew up in Downers Grove in DuPage County, which at the time was overwhelmingly Republican.
It's part of Illinois.
And part of Illinois. It's one of the collar counties of Cook County. And DuPage County traditionally offset much of the Democratic vote in Cook County. In the very contentious 1960 election, DuPage County had a very large turnout in favor of Richard Nixon. And the vote in Cook County was delayed. Of course, it raised lots of suspicions, and when it finally was released in the wee hours of the morning, it provided enough of an edge to give Kennedy Illinois and the election. I think that memory was reflected in parents' disappointment, but when news hit, I was in third grade at the time, and when many of the kids who had gone home for lunch came back, they were starting to cheer. And then when asked why they were cheering, they said the president was shot. When we got back into the classroom, our teacher was in tears, and she was just appalled by our behavior. And it was appalling behavior. I think
you were cheering as well.
Well, I don't know if I was cheering. I hope I wasn't. I don't know. I do know, though, that that was the reaction on the playground before we came back into the classroom. And it was a sobering moment. And it's one that stuck with me because, again, it's politics should never be personalized. You can disagree with someone. But you should. It should never be to the point where you wish them ill. Mm-hmm. And this also served, of course, in dealing with Lincoln. And when he was shot, there was a similar outrage in the North. But there were pockets in the North and then throughout the South that cheered his assassination. And it really does get to the point about how one should view politics and how one needs to understand that the president is first and foremost a human being, an individual. And to put whatever policy views or whatever that you might disagree with in a separate category because they're not always the same.
Tom Schwartz, not only a Lincoln historian, but also director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And I wanted to talk about the other anniversary this week. It is one of the best known speeches in American history, a speech given by our 16th president, a president also struck down, as you mentioned, by an assassin's bullet. And it was given November 19th, 1863, the Gettysburg Address. Where was the nation in the war, the Civil War at this point? What was the point of Lincoln's speech in that, I guess, a field in Pennsylvania?
That's correct. The Battle of Gettysburg was one of the bloodiest and largest battles in the war. Lincoln had not been initially thought of as the keynote. And so his invitation was kind of an afterthought. The organizers, because of the carnage, they needed to bury people actually on site rather than to ship their bodies back to their home states.
And the carnage was how many thousand?
Well, there were 25,000 that I believe over – and you have to understand the battle was over 3 days. So 25,000 casualties, not all of those deaths, but killed and wounded. The graves were kind of a slapdash affair, and then they realized that they needed to get proper burials. So they went to the states, got the money to create a national cemetery. And so this was essentially – the battle was July 1 through 4. And then in November, they were going to dedicate this national cemetery. They had already invited Edward Everett, who was the professor of classics at Harvard, considered one of the leading orators of the time. He immediately began on the speech. And then kind of as an afterthought, they approached President Lincoln asking if he would say a few appropriate remarks. Because of that afterthought, people thought that he wrote it on the train going to Gettysburg.
On the back of an envelope,
as well,
right?
And nothing could be further from the truth. Lincoln had actually, as soon as he got the request, began a draft. There are two drafts in the Library of Congress. One that was given to his personal secretary, John Nicolay, and the other to his other personal secretary, John Hay. Some historians think that the Hay copy was the reading copy. Both, though, are really drafts. Gary Wills, in his book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, claims that the reading copy Lincoln sent to Little Brown Publishers in Boston. Edward Everett had already made arrangements with them to publish both addresses and the proceedings of the day for sale to raise money for the war. And it's likely that he sent that reading copy to Little Brown, and then once it was typeset and corrected, they threw the original away. Everett went back to Lincoln and asked him for another copy to be included with his to be sold at a sanitary fair in New York. Those copies, Everett's three-hour address, Lincoln's three-minute address, are now in Springfield, Illinois, at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum. And ironically, that's the only copy of Everett's Gettysburg address in Everett's hand. His voluminous papers at the Massachusetts Historical Society contain only the printed copies from Little Brown and none of the drafts. And of course, he spoke also – had memorized it, so he spoke from memory for those – that three-hour oration. The fourth and fifth copies were done for George Bancroft. Bancroft was the leading literary light. He wanted Lincoln's copy to be reproduced in facsimile in a book of writings from famous American authors. This notion that Lincoln didn't think it was an important speech or that no one at the time recognized it, again, is balderdash.
A myth.
Bancroft immediately recognized it and wanted it included in this book. Lincoln wrote it out, sent it, but he used both sides of the paper, and they couldn't reduce the size to fit the size of the book. So Bancroft had to provide Lincoln with paper and asked him to do it again to give a title to it, to sign and date it.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned that there are multiple versions of it, because we heard this week a controversy about this in President Obama's reading of the Gettysburg Address, that he had removed the words "under God" from his reading of the address for a PBS documentary. Some conservative media reporting the story with headlines like "Obama cuts under God out of Gettysburg Address," that from the National Review. Mm-hmm. Then media on the left, Rachel Maddow, for instance, on MSNBC, mocking these attacks, pointing out that the maker of the documentary, Ken Burns, gave Obama a version of the speech that did not include the phrase "under God." So how many of the versions that you mentioned do not have "under God" in them, and why wouldn't they?
The first two, and largely because they're drafts. And we don't know if Lincoln used that phrase at the time of the speech, because some of the contemporary newspaper accounts include it and some don't. And so we simply don't know. Now, it is – first appears in the Everett copy, and it remains in the subsequent handwritten copies that Lincoln made. But ultimately, no two copies, handwritten copies, are exactly alike in wording. And this is why in Lincoln loved to polish his works, and he is constantly the editor at trying to improve his text in the meaning.
If we have we have about a minute or so left, but let's get your view on why this is seen as one of the greatest speeches in American history, 272 words long.
If one looks at it, Lincoln deals with he hearkens on the past and goes back to 1776 and the Declaration. You know that 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent, or on this continent, a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. This idea, inalienable rights, that all men have inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Lincoln was trying to refer to slavery without saying the word, and that blacks deserve this new birth of freedom that he talks about later. But he goes from past tense, reminding people of the revolutionary origins, to the present tense and talking about why they're there, why they're dedicating that battlefield, what these men died for. And they died for this cause that the nation might have a new birth of freedom. He's taught, this is the unfinished work, that this nation under God may have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the face of the earth. That this idea of self-government, which is very rare in the 19th century, that people have the ability to govern themselves, that was ultimately the reason for fighting the war. It was this notion that what the founders thought of a nation based on equality and on self-governance deserved to survive, that shall not perish from the earth.
Tom Schwartz, Lincoln historian, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, thank you for joining us. Remind us before we have to go, I know the Herbert Hoover Museum and Library has great things around the holidays. What do you have for people to come out and see?
Heartland Christmas is through January 2nd. And also go to our website. On our YouTube page, we have President Hoover's letter of condolence to Mrs. Kennedy.
Okay. Thank you very much. Tom Schwartz, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River, produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We want to say thanks to all those who called in and posted on our Facebook, emailed us with your remembrances of this day 50 years ago. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.